Hello, I'm Ridge Leox, Healthcare Program Coordinator for SABU. Welcome to today's teletraining, sponsored by a grant from the Commonwealth Fund, on the twisting fate of the Affordable Care Act and Texas v. the U.S. More than a year ago, a Texas judge ruled that the Affordable Care Act was unconstitutional because of the mandate requiring insurance, sending the fate of the hugely consequential law into the unknown. In December, a federal appeals court ruled that the mandate requiring insurance was unconstitutional, but it sent the rest of the case back to the Texas judge to, quote, conduct a more searching inquiry, end quote, into which of the law's parts could survive without the mandate. Just yesterday, the Supreme Court denied a request from 21 Democratic attorney generals and the House of Representatives to expedite a review of the case, which would have allowed the court to hear the case this year. What does this mean for the law? What does this mean for the 17 million people who use Obamacare? And what impact, if any, will this have on the 2020 election? Luckily, we have Katie Keith, who writes following the ACA blog for Health Affairs, and Shira Stein, healthcare policy reporter for Bloomberg Law, here to tell us what it all means and make it all make sense. So let's sit back and listen. If you have any questions, email them to sabu@sabu.org. Or you can use the chat function on Zoom. And with that, I turn it over to Shira and Katie. Thank you.
Hi, thank you all so much for joining us. We're just gonna jump right in. We're first gonna give some background and then talk about what's happened, especially in the last couple of days. So Katie, can you talk a little bit about the arguments and the ruling that was made in the district court decision?
Sure, and thank you for having me. Somehow the timing worked out perfectly to be having this conversation today. So thank you for organizing this to SABU and to Shira for being the co-pilot today. So to really understand what's going on in this case, we actually have to go back sort of to 2012, if you can believe it. And so in 2012, as folks remember, the Supreme Court issued their NFIB versus Sebelius decision. That was the first sort of Supreme Court challenge over the Affordable Care Act. In that NFIB case, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, came to the conclusion and really held that the individual mandate was constitutional under Congress's authority to tax. This was sort of somewhat controversial at the time. The mandate was not constitutional under Congress's commerce powers, but it sort of looked, talked, walked like a tax, and Congress has a lot of authority to tax, and so it was held constitutional. It's great, 2012, you know, the law sort of proceeds as usual. Things, major parts of it get implemented in 2014, and it's generally been stable ever since. Fast forward then from 2012 to 2017, and if folks remember back to 2017, this was, you know, President Trump's first year in office, and Republican held majorities in both the Senate and the House. And so in 2017, Congress spent an entire year with multiple sort of high-profile failed attempts to repeal and replace the ACA. Folks might remember, you know, John McCain with the big thumbs down, Paul Ryan having to cancel votes before the House ultimately passed a repeal bill. Again, throughout the entire year, there was this sort of big push to eliminate as much of the ACA as possible. Great. That brings us to sort of December 2017. All of these repeal efforts fail, and we get to Republicans' efforts to pass what's called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So that was the tax reform bill that Congress passed in December of 2017 using the budget reconciliation process. In that bill, they took the individual mandate penalty in the Affordable Care Act. It was set at $695, or sort of the greater of 2.5% of your income. So again, if folks did not have health insurance up to that point, they would pay a penalty of that amount. Instead, what Congress did in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was take that $695, cross it out and put in a zero, essentially eliminating the penalty for failing to have health insurance. I think of this as sort of the consolation prize for the failed attempts to repeal the law all throughout 2017. It sort of felt like the only thing they could get done in their tax bill at the end of the year was to repeal the individual mandate penalty. great, that could have been it. We all could have maybe moved on from the Obamacare trials and tribulations. Instead, that is not where we are. And in February of 2018, you had 20 Republican attorneys general and governors, joined later by two individuals in Texas, filed this lawsuit that we're all talking about. And so their claim essentially is that now that Congress has zeroed out that individual mandate penalty, the penalty and mandate no longer function as a tax. Why is that tax important? Because that is the only reason the Chief Justice in 2012 in NFIB was able to say that the ACA is constitutional. But they don't stop there. You know, I think maybe reasonable minds could disagree about whether the mandate is still constitutional or not. But what makes this argument sort of, in this case, so consequential is that the plaintiffs go on to argue the mandate itself is so essential and so vital to the entire rest of the Affordable Care Act that if the mandate is unconstitutional, the entire rest of the Affordable Care Act is invalid. And so you have a bunch of parties join California on behalf of a number of other states, and Democratic attorneys general asked to intervene in the case. You had the Department of Justice take some wild or, you know, unusual, let's say, positions in the case. Fast forward, that brings us to kind of December of 2018, late in the year. Judge Reed O'Connor, who's a federal district court judge in the Northern District of Texas, no stranger to ACA litigation, he fully agreed with the plaintiff in the case. So, you know, two Decembers ago, if you will, said yes, that the mandate penalty is, you know, the mandate itself is now unconstitutional and the entire rest of the ACA is invalid. So that sort of set the stage for an appeal, but sure, I might stop there since I think you only asked about the district court decision at this point.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out that the law was still active. Just because he made mm-hmm. this ruling did not mean that the ACA stopped being active. It's still active to this day and will likely continue to be so through the Supreme Court appeal, but that's getting a little ahead of ourselves. So let's talk a little bit. So district court judge strikes down, the mandate strikes down the entire law as a result of that. What happens with the appellate court, with the appeal and with the ruling at the appellate court, which is the ruling that we just received in the last month or so?
That's right. So pretty quickly, you actually saw the sort of California-led states, the Democratic attorneys general, and the Trump administration also appealed Judge O'Connor's decision to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is where, you know, the appellate circuit that Texas is in. Fifth Circuit is widely regarded as one of the most conservative appellate courts in the country. And so at this point, now you're thinking, so we had an election in November 2018, this district court decision was in December of 2018, and so you have a new Congress. So, you know, the Democrats retook the House in 2019. You had a number of sort of AG's offices and governor's offices flip, and so there's been some changes there. So where things are in terms of the parties right now and who was appealing to the Fifth Circuit, it's currently 18 Republican attorneys general and governors, and those two individuals in Texas, and then joined by the Department of Justice. So those are sort of all the folks arguing that the ACA is invalid or should be struck down. We started as 20 states, they went down to 18, given some elections in 2018. On the other side, you have 21 Democratic attorneys general. That had started at, I think, 16 or 17. And again, because of the elections, you had more Democratic AGs jump in beginning in 2019. And then once the House flipped at the federal level, you also have the House of Representatives asking to intervene as a party before the Fifth Circuit. So, you know, Republican AGs, two individuals, Trump administration on one side, 21 Democratic AGs, House of Representatives on the other side defending the ACA. So I just say that because it gets procedurally complex very quickly, but those are all the different parties in the case.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Shira.
And I think it's important to mention as well, in the midst of all this, the Trump administration Justice Department flipped its position to say that the entire law should fall as well. So initially they were not saying that. they were saying that just the mandate should fall. So that's sort of another complication in the appellate process, was that we had this massive flip in a kind of completely out of the norm two-sentence letter filed by the Justice Department.
That's exactly right. So they initially appealed, and even they had sort of said, they had always agreed that the mandate was unconstitutional, which was sort of a unique position. Generally speaking, the Department of Justice has sort of a longstanding history of defending federal law. If there's a reasonable argument that could be made for that law. So we don't have this sort of long history of administrations picking and choosing which laws they defend in court, and that is sort of precisely what happened here. So they had always taken the position that the mandate was unconstitutional, and initially they asked the court to sort of only also strike down various protections for people with pre-existing conditions. That was their position in the district court. Because the district court struck down all of the law, they technically lost the case, and that's one of the reasons they appealed. But Shira, you're exactly right. Almost right away, at the first point they were asked their position by the Fifth Circuit, they, you know, fully flipped to the sort of plaintiff side and said, we think the entire law should go. And so they are kind of more or less on the side with the plaintiffs, with the Texas Attorney General, in this case. So that's exactly right. But, you know, you've got kind of these five groups of parties, if you will, making the same argument. So it's the same sort of issues on appeal, things like, do the Republican-led states have standing to sue over the individual mandate? Do the two individuals have standing? Is the mandate now actually unconstitutional? You know, the California-led states are arguing that even without a penalty, the mandate is still constitutional. And then, you know, a lot of the arguments focused on severability. So even if the mandate's unconstitutional, does that mean really that the rest of the law is also struck down? And there's sort of longstanding Supreme Court precedent saying no, that generally speaking, you're supposed to do as little damage to a statute as possible. And in this case, that would mean striking down as little of the law as possible, you know, as you could, rather than doing what the district court did here, which was to strike down the entire law with doing what I would call sort of a cursory analysis in this case. And so you had, you know, there were all these filings, many of these arguments were being made once again before the district court, and then again at the Fifth Circuit. We had oral arguments in July before the Fifth Circuit. It was a three-judge panel, two Republican-appointed judges, one Democratic-appointed judge appointed by Carter, I want to say, in the 70s. So sort of a senior judge, if you will. But that was the panel, and they issued their decision sort of around the same time as Judge O'Connor, 1 year later. So in kind of late December of 2019, Fifth Circuit issued its opinion, partially agreeing with the district court and sort of punting on the rest of the case. And so what the Fifth Circuit said was, both the Republican states and the individual plaintiffs have standing to sue. So they didn't see any problem with, you know, the lawsuit being brought in the first place. So they have standing. The mandate without the penalty is unconstitutional. And then the key question of severability is one where I think to many people's frustration, they would actually do what's called remand. They would actually send the case back down to Judge O'Connor at the district court for more analysis, essentially. They sort of punted on this question of severability and said, you know, the district court really didn't do a good enough job here. Ridgely had a great quote kind of in her opening, you know, go back, use a finer tooth comb and go provision by provision of the ACA and tell us whether every one of those provisions is severable from the mandate or not. They were pretty clear in the majority, and it was a 2-1 decision from the Fifth Circuit. At least the majority said, we're not prejudging any outcomes here. So it's highly possible that Judge O'Connor could come back with the exact same outcome or exact same conclusion that the whole law should also be invalidated. But they at least want him to do a better job of doing the analysis. And of course, you have the Democratic appointed judge, Judge King, dissented, and she sort of would go completely the other way. She thinks there was no standing. We shouldn't have this lawsuit in the first place. even if there was standing, the mandate's constitutional. Even if the mandate were unconstitutional, it's fully severable from the rest of the law. And so she has some very kind of choice quotes about her, you know, and she was, I think, quite critical of the majority for punting on this issue of severability and sending it back down to the district court. So, you know, in many ways, where we are status quo, sure, you're right to emphasize the ACA is still fully in place. Everything is operating. There's no major changes. We just went through an open enrollment period. But there is this possibility of kind of this long drawn out process if we have to go back to the district court and restart this analysis all over again.
Yeah, and when Katie says that, you know, severing certain parts of the law, the ACA was not just creating the individual insurance market. It did a whole bunch of other things. It did things around nutrition. It created a Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. It created a pathway for certain types of living drugs called biologics to get approved. It did all sorts of other things that most people, it also allowed people to stay on their parents' health insurance until they were 26. There were a lot of provisions. The ACA was a massive law. And so if you strike down the entire law, it's not just striking down the individual insurance markets, it strikes down all of these other things that to some say are unrelated.
That's exactly right. I think the ACA touches every part of the healthcare system, from public health to FDA to Medicare to Medicaid. It's not sort of just this Obama, you know, I'm using air quotes, sort of Obamacare individual market. It really would have far-reaching effects if the district court's opinion is upheld.
Yeah. Before I move on to the Supreme Court appeal, you did bring up the fact that we just finished an ACA open enrollment period. Can you talk a little bit about how this affected ACA enrollment and why there was some surprise that the appeals court decision came after the end of open enrollment?
Yeah, great question. So things have been kind of remarkably stable. I think part of the reason that the district court concluded the way that it did was sort of this argument that, you know, again, the mandate's so essential and really sort of trotted out what I'll call like a parade of horribles of if you don't have the mandate, you know, the sky is going to fall, the markets are going to crash, everything's going to be, you know, quite bad. And this most recent open enrollment period, I think, is more evidence to the contrary. Things were, you know, enrollment has sort of bottomed out, at least through, we only have data from the healthcare.gov states. We don't have it yet for all 50 states, but generally speaking, it's down by, you know, 1 to 2 percentage points over previous years. So we're now sort of in the second year without the penalty being in place, and enrollment has been remarkably stable. And so there are all these, you know, I think health policy folks are not surprised by that. It's really coming down to this idea that there's subsidies and there's other components that have been much more important than the mandate penalty. And they would argue, you know, and myself included, that Congress knew that in 2017 when it was making the decision to zero out the penalty. But none of these sort of horrible impacts of getting rid of that penalty have really come to fruition. And so, you know, we've got 8.3 million people who continued to enroll this year for 2020, despite there not being a penalty in place. And so I think it's sort of that idea kind of cuts the real world experience that we're seeing with the market, I think cuts against some of the major arguments from the lawsuit itself about what the impact would be.
And there's also, when you say enrollment's down by 1 to 2%, we're still waiting on some states that have their own exchanges to come back. And there's a few new states that have started having their own exchanges this year. So that difference could be just due to a couple of new states having their own state exchanges.
That's right. And you also had a couple of states expand Medicaid. So if you look at the impact of Medicaid expansion in Virginia and Maine, for instance, that pulls folks out of the healthcare.gov market. You're totally right. Nevada moved from healthcare.gov to its own marketplace. So we should get much better sort of complete 50 state data. And, you know, depending on whether those states have an extra strong year for enrollment, we could actually see enrollment increase sort of year over year, but we'll know more in March. That'll be kind of the timeline when we get that good 50 state data.
Okay. And why were people surprised that the appeals court decision came after enrollment?
I think many folks had been at least sort of hoping. There's no hard and fast timelines on when courts have to issue decisions, for instance. And so there had been many folks hoping, you know, maybe we will see this opinion at least before the open enrollment period started. I mentioned that oral arguments were held in July, so you get a, you know, a couple months to write the opinion. Maybe we would have had this on an October-November timeframe. The conventional wisdom, and I don't think we'll ever know the answer to this, but, you know, given the timing, I believe it was December 19th, I want to say, when they issued the decision, it was right after the close of the December 15th deadline, and then even after a slight extension that the Trump administration gave for enrollment this year. And so the sort of conventional wisdom out there has been the court was didn't want to disrupt open enrollment, didn't want to cause confusion, didn't want to have headline, you know, confusing headlines for real people who might need health insurance out there. And so they sort of held off till the end of open enrollment. I don't think we'll ever know exactly what the thinking was. Maybe they were being intentional about that. Maybe they were not. But, you know, there was also some perhaps indications from the Trump administration early on, at least in the press, that they were not in a hurry to have this decision appealed. They didn't really want this case to go up to the Supreme Court during 2020. And so in many instances, I think the delay by the Fifth Circuit in issuing the decision and kind of waiting till late December also has ended up maybe delaying the possibility of Supreme Court issuing the decision this term, which, as we know from what happened yesterday, is the reality that we're dealing with.
Yeah, so let's get into what's happening, what's happened so far and what is happening now with the Supreme Court appeal. What sort of arguments were made and what happened yesterday, as you've alluded to a few times?
Sure. So you pretty soon after the Fifth Circuit decision, kind of right away in January, you had both the California Coalition and the House of Representatives file their, you know, what's called a cert petition with the Supreme Court. So appealing the Fifth Circuit's decision saying, please take this case, here's why. So in addition to filing that sort of typical request for Supreme Court review, both of those parties also filed a request for expedited review. And, you know, the reason for that is when you sort of file a cert petition, it kind of starts the clock on this process. There's filing deadlines that go with that. In the absence of kind of expedited review, if you were sort of going down that normal process in the Supreme Court filing, there would be pretty much no way that this case, the Texas case, could be put on the Supreme Court's docket for this year, for the 2019-2020 term. And so I think these parties knew that, and that's why they asked for kind of expedited review, meaning they wanted to hurry with the briefing process, come up with sort of a shorter timeline, and have oral arguments at the end of April or early May, and then try to have a decision issued in, you know, June 2020 at the latest. The argument there, and I think they made a lot of compelling arguments that were bolstered by a lot of healthcare stakeholders who filed amicus briefs in the case recently, was this idea that we can't have this cloud of uncertainty really hanging over the ACA. Sure, as you mentioned, it really touches every part of the healthcare system, and the idea, you know, hospitals have to make decisions about what they invest in. Health insurance companies have to decide if they're going to offer different products, and they have to do that, you know, pretty much a year in advance. We can't sort of just leave this issue looming. It's really important and really worth getting taken care of immediately and doing that in the 2020 term. There were, you know, the plaintiffs and the Trump administration made a number of arguments against that, saying, you know, there's no emergency here. The law remains in place. There's no reason to rush. We might want to file our own appeal. We need more time to do that, all those types of things. And so that is what the Supreme Court sort of ruled on yesterday. It would have taken five justices to vote to expedite this process and kind of speed up the briefing process. Again, sort of conventional wisdom was maybe that was going to be the four sort of more liberal justices, perhaps joined by the Chief Justice, that was kind of the configuration of if that was going to happen, that's how it would go down. That clearly they did not have five votes for expediting this process. And so that's the news we got yesterday. So we're certainly not going to see this Texas case on this docket. We're not going to have a decision about, you know, the full fate of the ACA by June, which sort of takes it a little bit out of the election context, which I'm sure we're going to talk more about. That said, the only thing that happened yesterday was a Supreme Court decision on whether to speed up the process or not. And so now what happens is, you know, the court's still going to consider the appeal request, if you will. So now they're just going to be on sort of the normal time frame of, you know, each party files their briefs, you get amicus briefs, they put it on the conference calendar, and then it's going to take four justices to vote whether or not to take the case, likely in the next term. So under this kind of normal process, you know, there could be some extensions and things like that, but that would put us in sort of the March-April timeframe for the briefing to be completed. And then the court will kind of sit in conference. You'll see if you have four justices vote in favor of that. And then it would be sort of, they would grant cert or deny cert. My expectation is that they grant this request and they take the appeal, but it really wouldn't start until the next term, which begins in October 2020. So you would likely see, you know, additional briefing, oral argument, kind of in the fall or spring, and then we would likely get a decision sort of the June 2021 timeframe. They could also deny cert, but I'll at least stop there. I think that's what we're looking at. So again, just to kind of summarize, the only thing yesterday was they're not going to speed up review of the case, and from here they'll just sort of consider it in their normal course under the normal schedule with the possibility that it appears before the court during the next term.
And I kind of saw an interesting conversation online from a patient advocate and attorney, healthcare attorney, talking about how actually the denial of expediting was a victory for patients who have benefited from the Affordable Care Act, saying that, you know, if the decision happened this year, then it could go in the favor of the Trump administration and the Republican states, but if it holds until the possibility of a new Democratic president, then they may be able to change the outcome. So that was kind of an interesting alternative perspective that I haven't heard as much talked about.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that a new administration could take a different position in the lawsuit. They, of course, would not be sworn in until sort of January of next year. And so by then, I think you'd have had oral arguments and, you know, maybe things would have already proceeded. In any event, though, I don't know how much it changes the outcome. You would still certainly have Texas and the individual plaintiffs, you know, arguing, making the same arguments to the court. So I think that's an interesting perspective. I take the point that a delay might not be bad for patients and for the healthcare system and for people who rely on the ACA. For instance, something I've spent some time thinking about or have questions about is if there is a delay, I think under this court, under these nine justices, most of the law, at least, is probably safe. We'll see what the court says about the individual mandate and whether it's constitutional. But on severability, it seems just looking at past precedent that I just can't see five justices being convinced that the entire AC should go. That under this court. That said, I think if there's a delay and this is pushed to the next term, as it is likely to be, you could also have a really different court by then. And so, you know, the delay on the one hand might be good to kind of preserve the status quo for now. Delay on the other hand might put the law in a more precarious position as time goes on, depending on who's on the court. So I would, who knows how all this is going to play out, but I think that is one of the concerns about having this being delayed at least for another year. And I should add, my expectation is that there's at least support of four justices to, you know, vote to grant the cert petition so that this does go up on the 2020-2021 term. If there is not four votes in support of that, you would essentially see the case isn't over. It just gets kicked back down to Judge Reed O'Connor to do this sort of severability analysis. And he could come back, you know, with any type of conclusion. He could make the same conclusion that the whole law should go, that just major parts of it should go, none of it should go, although I think that's very unlikely. that would get again appealed to the Fifth Circuit, and then it would get again go up to the Supreme Court likely. And so that would be sort of maybe a 2 to 3 year process at a minimum. And so, you know, I fully expect the Supreme Court to take this case up for the next term. If they don't, we're not done, and it just continues to play out for a really long time. And that's one reason why, again, you have all these amicus briefs filed, I think, last week, saying we're health insurance companies, we're hospitals, we're patient groups. We can't be living under this cloud of uncertainty for any length of time. The Supreme Court really needs to take this up and decide once and for all what they want to do here.
Yeah, so it looks like healthcare reporters and healthcare attorneys and people like you, Katie, could be writing about this case for the next few years.
And in the year when the Affordable Care Act is turning 10, right, this is the decade anniversary, and we're still kind of talking about another major Supreme Court challenge to the law and whether it's going to stick around. So, but I think that's exactly right. There's not going to be any shortage of coverage on this issue, for better or worse.
Definitely. So can we talk a little bit about what this means for the 2020 election and what could a new Democratic president do?
Sure. So, you know, some of this is a little bit above my pay grade on the politics, but I, you know, there's sort of arguments on both sides of that. It's certainly clear that the Trump administration did not want the Supreme Court to sort of take and decide this case in 2020, in sort of the summer of 2020, as you lead up to the height of an election year. It is no surprise, I'm sure, to anyone on this call. Healthcare was a big sort of animating issue, and you know, both efforts to roll back in 2017 were really important in the 2018 midterm elections. And so I think a lot of folks are hoping, or were hoping, and probably are still going to sort of capitalize on the fact that this lawsuit exists in the first place, that, you know, there's this sense that Republican-led lawsuit with, you know, 18 states at this point is still trying to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, and that they've been fully joined and sort of fully embraced by the Trump administration. I think there was this goal of having a Supreme Court decision that would really bring that to the forefront, and kind of, you know, put that out loud and clear. My sense is that even if the Supreme Court is not deciding that in June of 2020, that's still going to be at the top of folks' minds, and you know, groups like Protect Our Care are going to, you know, run ads on this and make sure that folks know exactly kind of where the president is and some of these state leaders are on trying to dismantle the ACA through the courts. And I think the argument there is these leaders are trying to use the courts to sort of judicially repeal the ACA after they failed to you know, accomplish the job in Congress in 2017. So still kind of continued threats and attacks on coverage for people with pre-existing conditions is something we're going to keep hearing about a lot, I think. But, you know, does delaying the case, I think there's the concern that given all the other things that are going on out there, not having a case or not having it be on, you know, what's at least looking like an 18-month time frame before we get a Supreme Court decision at the earliest, if you will. Does it take some, I think there's concern that maybe it takes urgency away from this messaging, or it sort of obscures the position the Trump administration has taken in the case, that kind of thing. So I do think there were some supporters who really felt it was important to get this decided this year, both for clarity's sake and to kind of really put in full force and make it really visible to voters exactly where their elected officials stood on this issue. And absent that, I think there will still be efforts to do that. They just might not be as easy to put front and center, if you will. That's sort of my take on where that is. And, you know, even as we think about the Democratic primary debate and, you know, whether it's more ACA improvement versus Medicare for all versus something in the middle of that spectrum, you know, I think there was perhaps going to be a moment where everyone could agree that at least the ACA should stick around. And, you know, in fact, every Democratic primary candidate thinks that, but you can imagine the lawsuit is sort of a rallying cry of even putting aside the differences in the Democratic Party, we have to sort of maintain support and protect, you know, the Affordable Care Act, given all the progress that has been made under the law. So it could have also been kind of a rallying cry, perhaps for the Democratic Party itself. But we'll, still might be, right? this is my speculation. I think the conventional wisdom was just that it would have been easier if it had kind of stayed at the forefront of the headlines. But yeah, go ahead, Shira.
Yeah, I know it's been a somewhat confounding thing for a lot of political analysts and reporters that Democrats haven't focused as much on the ACA and protecting pre-existing conditions and this lawsuit during this presidential primary, because that was how they won the midterm elections in 2018. I mean, I was covering it at the time, and I was seeing candidate after candidate talk about protecting pre-existing conditions and winning in these traditionally red or purple districts. And so it was kind of, it's been surprising watching the debates. I was talking during the last debate with somebody else in our newsroom, and they were surprised to hear Elizabeth Warren come out in support of the ACA. And I was like, why is that surprising? And you know, every Democrat's going to be is in favor and has said they're in favor of the Affordable Care Act, especially in light of this lawsuit. So it's fascinating to me that it hasn't been as much of an issue that Democrats have used to bring the party together. So maybe that will be what happens after the primaries are done and a nominee has been chosen. But I think it's kind of a confounding thing that they haven't done that yet.
Right. I think that's right. And then in the meantime, the Trump administration has taken a number of confusing positions in the case, but they have always sort of been in favor of having the court strike down the pre-existing condition protections. And then I know something we were talking about before, there has always been nods to having some sort of, you know, grand ACA replacement plan in place, whether that was around the 2017 repeal debate, something CMS Administrator Verma was tasked with, and then you have but has never come to fruition, right? And the president has sort of continuously promised this, like, we have a great plan, it's coming, wait and see. And then you even have, I think, the administration backing away from that now, given the delay from the court decision. So talk yesterday or today from Secretary Azar sort of saying, well, we don't really need that plan at this moment. It's not urgent because we're not going to have a decision from the court for a long time now. And so do you even see that sort of promise getting pushed back even further on sort of the Republican side as well? So I think for Republicans, it probably, again, it sort of obscures the fact that this lawsuit is happening. Maybe a lot of voters don't even know that this is an issue or that this is a threat. But it also, I think, takes the pressure off to come up with what that replacement plan is or what the alternative vision for healthcare in America might be from the Republican Party.
Definitely. And if there is a new Democratic president elected, can you talk a little bit about what they could possibly do to either save, sever, or sink the ACA?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the timing will be tough, you know, being sworn in sort of January. We'll have to see what the Supreme Court does. Again, I'm sort of assuming they're going to take up this case for the next term. But a lot of the filings and work and arguments might have already been made by that point. So I'm not quite sure how much of an impact. They could still sort of file a different opinion and make changes, I suppose. I just don't know how much of an impact it would have on the court process. That said, I would imagine that a Democratic president would, you know, want to work with Congress in the event that, you know, the court does something dramatic. And if there are parts of the ACA that are struck down, you would probably, you know, there's just not a lot, I think, that a Democratic president without the support of Congress could do on their own, depending on what the court's going to say. And so it would be really rallying support in Congress. And you mentioned this, Shira, it's not like, even if the mandate is, you know, all this is hinging on the mandate itself. And so even if parts of the law are held to be invalid, really the target of Congress's action could be the mandate to sort of fix whatever the court says is wrong. And I'm probably saying that in a really confusing way. But the idea here is that if the mandate really is the issue. And so some scholars have floated this idea of save, sever, or sink. And so could you get out from under all the problems with this lawsuit if you saved, if Congress were to save, air quote, you know, save the individual mandate, the idea there would be, could you just take it from $0 and instead put in $5 or $1? And then you have saved the mandate. It now, again, operates like a tax. It become, you know, transforms back to being constitutional. And then you don't have to worry about any of these other effects. So that's, you know, something that some have advocated for Congress to do. So you could save, you could sever, you could add a severability clause to the ACA. It does not currently have one, which is, you know, one of the reasons this is sort of before the court, or, you know, one of the reasons Judge O'Connor's been tasked with going provision by provision. Congress could go in and just add a severability clause so that you're not sort of running into this issue over and over again if parts of the law are found unconstitutional. The last sort of option folks have floated is to sink the individual mandate itself. And so part of the argument right now is that, you know, Congress only changed the penalty. They set it to zero, but they left the sort of text of the mandate in place. So it still looks like their argument, you have to buy coverage, even if it's a $0 penalty. So if you actually went in and deleted that reference that still looks like a command of some kind, just wipe it from the books and get rid of the text, do you then avoid this constitutionality problem? And so, you know, if what you could anticipate happening is if the Supreme Court, again, does maybe this court, maybe a different court, does something more dramatic than what many of us are expecting, this is what I would anticipate having in Congress. You'd start having this debate about, do you save, sever, or sink, or do you, you know, do something more large scale to the Affordable Care Act? And you would imagine sort of both sides of the aisle trying to maximize their leverage under the threat of, you know, perhaps major parts or the entire ACA being under threat. So I just want to emphasize it, you know, even if this case goes fully forward, you wouldn't it's not like Congress would have to reenact the ACA. They could just fiddle with the mandate, fix this constitutionality issue, and then in theory, the law is then once again okay. And I think that sort of underscores how ludicrous this legal challenge is and sort of where we are, that, you know, you could make some of these sort of small tweaks and then save the entire thing. And it just, in many ways, kind of, I think, highlights the vulnerabilities of the plaintiff's arguments, at least in my opinion. So hopefully that made sense. That was a little bit wonky, and I apologize. But, you know, that kind of save, sever, sink is an option that I think a new Democratic president, and then likely, you know, if whatever the new Congress looks like, we'll probably be thinking about and hearing a little bit more about as we go into 2021.
Yeah. And I've actually been hearing about the save, you know, $1 or $5 individual mandate for a few months now. And a couple of you I've asked have said, you know, if they did do this, it could possibly lend more credit to the plaintiff's argument. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's why Congress hasn't done it at this, or at least the House hasn't passed something like this at this point. But I think it's so confounding.
Yep, I think that's right. I think there's concern if Congress were to do it now, that I don't think it would get through this. There's no possibility of that becoming law. So even if you had support, I think, in both the House and the Senate, it's unclear to me that President Trump would sign that sort of bill right now. And so in addition to it maybe not being politically feasible, it could, which is exactly what you're saying, kind of could show that Congress also thinks there's a problem with the law. Like, it could be evidence kind of in the court case that Congress thinks there's a constitutionality problem when, you know, perhaps they don't, right? Or, you know, the argument is Congress knew exactly what it was doing in 2017 and didn't think it was putting the rest of the law at risk. So I totally agree with you. I think that's why we haven't seen it kind of in the current environment that we have.
Yeah, and it's been kind of interesting because a few Republicans have come forward and said, no, this was not the intent that we had. And yet there's still the Republican governors and attorneys general are still making that argument in the court case. So I wonder if it would factor in at all in later arguments.
That's right.
You talked a little bit about standing earlier. Can you talk about what standing issues may come up at the Supreme Court?
Sure. So, you know, standing is this idea that to bring a lawsuit in the first place, you know, the party bringing the lawsuit has to be, you know, sort of injured, they have to face some kind of injury because of what they're challenging, and that, you know, that has to be sort of a direct result of whatever it is that they're challenging. And so there was a lot of discussion. The district court, well, let me just start here. I mean, this idea that you have states, so Republican AGs representing states, challenging the individual mandate itself, I think already raises some standing questions of, you know, how is the state employees, state government, how are states impacted by this mandate itself? You know, the arguments that they've made were essentially that, well, the mandate is still in place. That makes more people enroll in Medicaid and CHIP, which the state partially pays for, and that makes more employees enroll in the state employee health plan, which the state pays for. There was sort of no evidence about this given, but that is the argument the states have made. I actually think there were sort of these two individual plaintiffs in Texas. They were added after the case was filed, and I believe that was to bolster the claim of standing for the plaintiffs. And so these are two sort of self-employed individuals in Texas who are essentially argued that they are harmed by the $0 penalty because they want to follow the law. They read the law as still compelling them to buy health insurance. And so they're going to continue to buy health insurance because the mandate is on the books, even if there's no financial penalty for them having to do so. So those are the arguments they're making about why they have the ability, all these parties have the ability to challenge the constitutionality of the mandate in the first place. I think there's a number of good arguments against why there is no standing. And this is actually where a lot of, I think, conservative legal scholars come at this issue of there is no way anyone is harmed by that there's any sort of injury by a $0 penalty. And there's language from the NFIB case from Chief Justice Roberts back in 2012 sort of saying, you know, this is a choice. It's not a compulsion to buy coverage. It's a choice to buy coverage or pay, you know, this tax. And so what California and the House and I think a lot of these legal scholars as well have argued is that nothing about what Congress did in zeroing out the penalty changed that. It's still a choice. You can choose to buy coverage or you can choose to pay a $0 penalty. Nothing about this sort of gives rise to an injury that should give these parties standing to sue. And so, it's been sort of a hot topic. Judge O'Connor, kind of a sleeper topic, I think, but Judge O'Connor didn't even rule on whether the states had standing. His entire opinion is based on the fact that those two individuals in Texas had standing to sue, that they're harmed by this sort of existential injury, that they want to follow the law, and so that they're doing that. That's another argument that California and other states make, is you can't have a self-inflicted injury, is what they're arguing, that doesn't give you standing to sue. But he, you know, O'Connor at the district court level only ruled on the individual plaintiffs, did not talk about the states. At the Fifth Circuit, the majority, the two judges of the Fifth Circuit said, we think both the individual plaintiffs and the state plaintiffs have standing. And they made a number of arguments. Why, as I mentioned, the dissent said there is no standing here. This is very much sort of a self-inflicted injury, and the states didn't show enough evidence that, they're actually harmed by the individual mandate itself. So I think standing is going to come up. It's already kind of factoring into the briefs that we've seen before the court now. I think it's going to continue to get a lot of attention. But even that alone, you know, why is the Texas Attorney General, why is the state of Texas harmed by the $0 penalty for the individual mandate is a really good question and one for folks to think about.
So what actions have states taken on this to try and preempt possible outcomes?
Yeah, so the states are trying a lot of different things. I think the truth of the matter is if the district court opinion holds, you know, if the entire ACA is invalid or if major parts of even the individual insurance provisions like Title I of the Affordable Care Act are invalid, there is pretty much nothing a state can do to make up for it. Right now, you see states sort of passing their own individual mandates, which is all well and good. Some are sort of taking you know, the consumer protections in the ACA and baking them into state law. Some are even, you know, as you mentioned, kind of moving to their own marketplaces and things like that. But so there's a world in which, you know, the Supreme Court says just the pre-existing condition protections are invalid, or Title I is invalid, or, you know, they can kind of draw the line in different places depending on their analysis. So there, if there's sort of a narrow ruling from the Supreme Court, and I'm using narrow in air quotes because it wouldn't be narrow at all, but there's something states could do to say, like, we're going to reinstate those pre-existing condition protections for our residents. But the truth is, if it's all of Title I, or if it's Medicaid expansion, or for states, I think the big question is funding, you know, federal funding. They're getting hundreds of billions of dollars in federal funding, whether it's for Medicaid or ACA subsidies. And if any parts of, you know, if the ACA, any parts of the ACA on that is touched, there's very little a state, even a state like California, could do to make up that gap. So, you know, that was kind of a long, complicated answer. I mean, the short answer is it really depends on the ruling about whether states can insulate themselves from this or not. And, you know, the reason that there's so many Democratic attorneys general in the lawsuit is because they see a real risk here. I think they can do some things, but if major parts of this law are found invalid, there's very little states are going to be able to do to protect themselves.
And just a reminder to everybody listening in that if you have any questions, you can put it in the Zoom chat, or you can email us at sabu@sabu.org, because we are coming close to the end of this. I know this isn't the lawsuit that's happening around the ACA right now. What's some of the other litigation that you're watching? And can you talk a little bit about another ACA lawsuit that the Supreme Court recently decided to take up?
Sure. So there is, at least for the blog, I'm probably covering, I don't know, maybe 50 cases at any given point, because just so much of the ACA, so much health policy, I would say, is tied up in litigation these days. But it is true. There are actually two other ACA-related cases that are going to be before the Supreme Court this term. So, you know, if you maybe add that, it was probably unlikely that they were going to take a third case, which would be the Texas case here. So the first case that they took up is over unpaid risk corridor payments to insurance companies. So this would be whether insurance companies are owed about $12 billion in unpaid risk corridor payments. That was a program that was in place from 2014 to 2016. So it doesn't have a lot of kind of ongoing impact, but could be, you know, pretty significant sum of money coming to insurance companies who participated during those years. So oral argument was held in the Supreme Court on that case on December 10th, and they could issue a decision sort of at any time. I don't know if that's going to be kind of a big blockbuster June decision. It strikes me not. Risk corridor seems a little bit wonkier than that, so maybe we'll get that beforehand, but that's one that we're going to see that's definitely ACA related. The second one that they just agreed to take last week is sort of the third Supreme Court consideration of the ACA's birth control mandate. So the contraceptive coverage requirements that folks might remember resulted in the Hobby Lobby case before the Supreme Court. There was kind of a follow-on case, something called Zubik, in 2016, where the Supreme Court sort of punted on the issue and said, this is when they only had eight justices because there was a fight over Merrick Garland. And, you know, the sort of tea leaf reading there is that it was a divided court, sort of 4-4, and they couldn't come to an agreement. So they just sort of said, we don't want to deal with this, let the lower courts deal with it again. And so here, this case is essentially over new Trump-era rules on the birth control mandate. When the Trump administration came in, the president signed an executive order, and then a number of agencies sort of did regulations and allowed a new religious, sort of a broad religious exemption, and then a broad moral exemption. And the idea there is that if you were an employer who has a religious or moral objection to contraceptive coverage, you are now exempt from the birth control mandate. Previously, there was sort of an accommodations process that you would have to go through to make sure your employees still got access to birth control. These new rules under the Trump administration just make that entirely optional, And so the idea is that it would leave those employees without access to contraceptives. So the fight here and this, you know, a number of state AGs in Pennsylvania, New Jersey on the one hand, California on the other, challenged these moral and religious exemption rules. The Ninth Circuit and the Third Circuit both invalidated the rules. They had sort of never gone into effect. And the Trump administration and Little Sisters of the Poor, which is sort of a religious entity that played a big role in a lot of the religious litigation we've seen, asked the Supreme Court to take the case. And last week we heard that they will. And so maybe, I think we're going to, the Supreme Court could maybe rule very narrowly and say, you know, this was a procedural issue, the rule is valid or it's invalid, or they could use it as a, you know, sort of an opportunity to revisit their case law on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. They could, you know, talk a lot more about whether it's okay to have religious or moral exemptions, that kind of thing. So it's one that I'm watching that could, it could actually have a significant potential in a number of areas, not just sort of narrowly on the birth control mandate, but we'll see. I'm not super surprised that they took it up. You sort of have, you know, it's sort of the impact, I would say, of the Trump appointed justices, where you have Gorsuch and Kavanaugh now on the court. There were clearly four votes for them to take it up, and we'll see what the court does with the latest saga on the birth control mandate. So more to come on that. They haven't scheduled oral arguments, to my knowledge, or things like that. They're sort of, they'll start the briefing process. And then, but we were expecting oral arguments kind of this year and then a decision no later than sort of July.
Great. Well, I think that was all the questions that I had. Was there anything else that you wanted to address, Katie, that you think people should know, or any stories that you think people aren't writing and maybe should be?
Let's see. I do think the point that you made is one that is not well understood, which is that there's a lot more in the ACA than people realize. And so it actually puts a lot more, this lawsuit in particular, the Big Texas case, puts a lot more at risk than a lot of folks are aware of. I also think, you know, it's, we are coming up on the 10th anniversary of the law. So the law was signed March 23rd, 2010. So March 2020 is kind of a big, it's a big year for the law, and there's, you know, going to be a lot of writing about this, but, you know, including perhaps the impact of the lawsuit and what it might mean for the future of the law and the future of the healthcare system in any of those kind of ACA at 10 stories that folks are considering. It's just, it's going to be a good time to take stock of where we are in the ACA. And, you know, I just think that this politically motivated challenge, legal challenge, again, plays a role in that, and we'll see. But I think those would be kind of the major things. It would just be helpful to keep talking about the lawsuit and what's at risk here for millions and millions of people.
Okay. Well, I think that's everything, and we haven't gotten any questions last minute, so I think we're going to wrap it up a couple of minutes early. Thank you, everyone, so much for joining us, and thank you, Cebu, for hosting this, and the Commonwealth Foundation for providing the funding. And thank you so much.
And I'm going to jump back in here. This is Ridgely, and I'm going to thank you, Katie, and thank you, Shira. This was brilliant and wonderful, and you know, just so important for us to understand what's going on, because this has such great consequences for all of us. And I also want to just thank again the Commonwealth Fund for the supplying the grant for this, and say that on March 11th, we are going to be having a day-long conference at the Commonwealth Fund headquarters in Manhattan, and we'll be sending invitations out for people to join us there. So again, thank you all so much, and you know, happy writing.
Thanks.